From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
La Playa.
I live in the Transmission.
Haight-Ashbury.
I'm in the sunny but filthy Mission.
Coming up, how we deal with kids who commit crimes.
I won't say that I'm handicapped, but it has, in a way, kept me back.
Governor Jerry Brown has proposed shutting down the state's Division of Juvenile Justice. It's a cost-saving measure, but it could have a high cost for young offenders.
So we're taking them out of not very great facilities with kind of passable programming, and we're putting them into hell.
Also, we'll take you to a bar in San Francisco where they're serving beer, wine, and opera.
We wanted to just be able to do our art without having to get permission from someone on a granting panel.
Leave your preconceptions at the door and join us for Cross Currents. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court took up the issue of life without parole for juvenile offenders. The question for the justices is whether children who commit murder should have the chance at some point in their lives to prove they should be set free.
So you have a ton of research that shows that adolescent brain development is not complete through the early 20s. And to have a sort of the finality of a life without parole sentence for something where you basically have a youth making decisions very impulsively and not able to really look at the long-term consequences of their actions. We as a state should not be subjecting young people who are still in the process of maturing to a sentence that's so final as life without parole.
Sumaya Wahid is the Books Not Bars campaign director at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. Wahid says this idea of children who commit crimes having the chance to redeem themselves is the foundational principle behind juvenile justice, which is why the Ella Baker Center has worked for years to close down the California Division of Juvenile Justice, formerly known as the California Youth Authority. Governor Jerry Brown has proposed shutting down the DJJ to help balance the state's budget. As it stands, the DJJ operates 5 prisons, 2 camps, and 8 parole offices. It oversees more than 1,000 juvenile offenders, 80% of whom recidivate after their release. So if there's no DJJ, critics wonder what the state will do with kids who commit serious crimes. In a story that originally aired last year, KALW's Rena Palta reports on when Governor Brown first tried to shut down the DJJ. And a note to our listeners, some of the names in this story have been changed to protect the privacy of children whose criminal records have been sealed.
It's a sunny weekend in the Bay Area, and Freddie is watching 3 of his little brothers turn the front driveway into a skateboard ramp.
A lot of my brothers are skaters, which I'm happy that they're skaters and not gangsters. So I'd rather them be skaters, dedicate their time to that, than to be running the streets like I was when I was a kid.
Today, Freddie is 24, but when he was younger, about the age of his preteen brothers, he spent time at juvenile hall and on probation. The first time was for assaulting someone during a fight.
And the second time I got incarcerated for trying to sling, which is sell drugs in school. I did a week for that and got out. And this is the third time I got incarcerated, which I think it was 2000, the day after Thanksgiving. No, it was that day. It was on a Friday, actually. I don't know what time, but that was a crazy day.
That day, Freddie shot a rival gang member. His charge on attempted murder sent him not back to the county juvenile hall, but to the California Youth Authority, the state's juvenile correction system, now known as the Division of Juvenile Justice. After 10 years in the DJJ, Freddie got out about 2 weeks ago.
I won't say that I'm handicapped, but it has, in a way, kept me back.
On one hand, Freddie will have a clean record when he gets off parole on his 25th birthday. He was put in the system as a juvenile. Whatever he did as a kid will not follow him into adulthood, at least not on paper. But is he ready to succeed as an adult?
The whole spirit of it is a second chance.
Barry Crisberg is the research and policy director of the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute at Berkeley's Law School. In the 1990s, the juvenile system hit its peak of 10,000 wards, and the facilities became crowded. They were gang-infested, and kids who misbehaved would spend months inside lockups.
Found the conditions were horrid. some of the worst that anyone had ever documented in juvenile justice.
And that second chance wasn't turning into anything. The latest available data, which is from 2005, shows that about 81% of wards released from DJJ were arrested within 3 years of release. About 56% either returned to DJJ or entered an adult prison within 3 years. Those kinds of numbers led to a lawsuit against the DJJ in 2003 by the Prison Law Office. Governor Schwarzenegger chose not to fight it and agreed to make changes.
The state promised that it would fix the system.
Dan McAleer is the director of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice.
That it would abandon these old prison-like facilities, get rid of the gang subculture, get rid of the violence, place kids in situations where they truly could be rehabilitated, where they could be housed in safe facilities.
Some things have changed, McAleer says. The current population in the system has decreased about 90% to 1,200 wards. Several facilities have been closed, and fewer kids end up in lockups. As for promises that the system would fundamentally change and start focusing on rehabilitation,
the state promised that back in 2004. And since that time, they have failed in that effort.
Which is why McAleer supports Governor Jerry Brown's new proposal to completely shut down the DJJ. Citing the $28 billion budget gap, Brown has proposed to completely dismantle the state system, which currently spends about $234,000 per child each year. The savings, according to Brown, would total $250 million and put the responsibility of care and reform of these offenders back on the county. Is this a good idea? Turns out, intelligent minds disagree.
I think that that's the direction we need to go.
It seems to me it's a step backward.
Dan McAleer and Barry Crisberg, both juvenile justice reformers, have different takes on the matter. At the heart of each of their opinions is a debate over who would best prepare these kids for adulthood, the county or the state. We don't yet have any details of Governor Brown's plan, like how much money he plans on giving the counties to absorb more kids, or where the most troubled kids will be housed. But to some people, like Crisberg, the idea of tearing up the DJJ sounds crazy. Why transfer responsibility to a set of uncoordinated counties that don't have regulations, uniformity, or any guarantee that they'll even treat the kids better than the state? Crisberg says some county facilities are known for being worse than the state's.
So we're taking them out of not very great facilities with, you know, kind of passable programming, and we're putting them into hell.
There are all kinds of things in Brown's budget proposal that are going to put pressure on the counties, especially in the criminal justice arena. There's a proposal to put low-level offenders in county jail and to move parole supervision of many offenders to county probation departments. Who's going to pay for all this, and what will prevent the state from simply walking away and leaving the counties to pick up the pieces?
That's really an important question.
Dan McAleer of the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice says the next few months are going to be important to figuring out the answer.
The state will have to maintain its promise, of course, but I think it'll be easier to maintain that promise, for example, in this instance, without the dual responsibility of, one, trying to maintain a very expensive but failed state system, and at the same time trying to prop up the county systems.
As the state is considering leaving behind an old system, Freddie is trying to leave behind his record and start fresh.
Here I am now, and since I've been out, I've been doing everything I have to do to maintain myself out of trouble.
Most importantly, Freddie says he values patience, something he learned in the correctional system, and something he'll need as he tries to navigate this new life and leave the old one behind. For Cross Currents, I'm Rena Palta.
Governor Brown's proposal to shut down the Department of Juvenile Justice is expected to be debated in the legislature over the next few months. For more on what changes are happening in the prison system, check out our criminal justice reporting at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. To continue our conversation about the state of youth corrections in California, we're joined by Michael Miner. On March 1st, Governor Brown appointed him Chief Deputy Secretary of the Division of Juvenile Justice at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. That makes it his job to help shape the future for this department that's potentially on the budget chopping block. I asked Miner to tell me more about what the Division of Juvenile Justice does.
The Division of Juvenile Justice currently provides services to, as you said, about 1,000 young men and 31 young women who are the most troubled youth in California. They are your serious violent offenders and also sex offenders. So the population that we are providing services to are young men and young women who has gone through the county system, who need further services, and those services are best provided at this time by the Division of Juvenile Justice.
And do you consider these young people a threat to public safety?
I believe these young people are troubled youth who have some serious and violent crimes that need a great deal of treatment and rehabilitation services to prepare them to go back into the community so that they won't make those same mistakes and create victims or commit additional crimes.
So let's assume I'm a young man. I'm 19 years old. I'm in for felony assault, say. What does my day look like?
If they're not a high school graduate, they should be involved in school. Or either if they're a high school graduate, they should be involved in vocational programs. As an example, in 2010 and 2011 academic year, we graduated over 556 young men and women. They either received a GED, a high school diploma, or a certificate of vocational or technical trade. Also, we are implementing a large array of treatment groups. It may be, if you're a sex offender, you may be involved in sex behavior treatment program groups. If the YARs identify that you have high violence, you may be included in the anger interruption therapy group, or you may be in Counterpoint. Those are some of the groups that we offer. And then other groups such as life skills or other pro-social activities that will help build character and help the young people get ready to go back into our communities.
Now, one highly publicized case of treatment inside of the Division of Juvenile Justice was the revelation that kids were being educated in cages because they were seen as a threat to public safety of the teachers. Is that still happening?
No. Several years back, there were some of the most violent young men were being housed in what was called at the time special management programs. And in there were individual education booths. They were identified and they would be put in the booth and a teacher would sit outside and provide education in that manner to keep the young men from becoming involved in violence. Those no longer exist. Those booths no longer exist. Now what we do, we have a behavior treatment program, which is for the most difficult young people. It's has a cap of 24 young people can be in that housing, that living unit. And there's four teachers for each of those five youth. So you have five young men in a classroom, and you would have one youth correctional counselor and one teacher in that classroom to deliver services in that manner. So the picture that you may have seen some years ago where a young man was sitting in booths, no, that's not the case any longer.
And you say that it's basically the most violent and troubled offenders that are still in DJJ. Everybody else has been gone back to counties and into programs, et cetera. So one of the other big allegations about what was formerly the CYA, the California Youth Authority, was that it was essentially a school for gladiators, that it was a place where these kids were preyed upon and that it was a very, very dangerous place to be. How have you remedied that?
Our housing units now are occupied on a core program, which is a general population living unit. The max is 38 young people. On our sex behavior treatment programs, there are 36. On our mental health programs, there are 24 young people. That in itself helped alleviate some of the pressure around that. And to couple with that, we've hired professional staff that make up the treatment teams. Those treatment teams are made up of clinical psychologists, youth correctional counselors, casework specialists or case managers, and you have the supervisors and the treatment team program managers there to help facilitate the treatment process. So everything is done now as a multidisciplinary approach to providing treatment. It focuses on creating a pro-social behavior that's therapeutic, that's supportive, and to help young people identify what their problems are, help them look for solutions to their problems, to their behavior. And I think those things has made a tremendous impact.
And one of the things that James Bell said in the interview that you heard that you wanted to respond to was that he didn't think any young people needed to be in DJJ. He thought that communities that they came from could provide those services to help kids who are struggling.
Again, DJJ has always believed in supporting the youth with support from their families. We have reached out to families as part of the treatment process. The counties have a great deal of responsibility. If these young men can and women can do better in the counties can be a better job of helping them get on their feet, I'm not opposed to that. But I do, again, just have to repeat that the state system, the Division of Juvenile Justice, at this time currently has a place, and our place is to do the best job we can in rehabilitating and helping these young people.
And you've worked in corrections for 27 years. You just recently took over as the director of the Division of Juvenile Justice. How have you seen California's correction system, particularly with respect to young people, evolve? I mean, it was just a few years ago that the California Department of Corrections put rehabilitation back into its actual name.
Well, it never changed for the Division of Juvenile Justice. I mean, when it was California Youth Authority, when I came into the organization, it was known as the national leader and was looked to for creative ideas around treatment and rehabilitation. And over the years, policy changes made a difference in the way that we have done business. I mean, we went from a treatment-oriented facilities to one that was more custody and control. And now we're moving back. We're shifting back to that area where we realize that locking them up and throwing away the key is not the answer, that these young people need lots of treatment. They need lots of support in order to leave our facilities and go out and be productive citizens. And that's what we're focused on.
Governor Brown has proposed to shut down the DJJ altogether. Where do you stand on that?
If that decision is made, then our job is to do the best plan we can to help transition young folks back to the communities. But in the interim, I see our role as doing the best job we can to provide service to the young people that we have in our care. And so my focus as a director and my constant message to the staff is we can't take our eyes off the ball. We have to remain committed to the job that we are tasked to do. We are public servants. We have a great task ahead of us. We have a very needy population, and that's where our focus is. If that policy decision is made, then we work closely with the counties to make that transition as transparent and effective as possible.
That's Michael Miner, Director of the Division of Juvenile Justice at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. So what do you think about the state of juvenile justice in California? You can join our conversation by leaving us a message at 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your voice on the air. You can also connect with us on Facebook. We're KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for Artery, cultural coverage that sings everything from down-home blues to divine arias. The San Francisco Opera is a world-renowned organization performing some of the world's most celebrated stories in a stunning 3,000-seat theater. While the War Memorial stage draws opera's greatest divas, the art form doesn't have to be heard in gilded halls. In fact, as KALW's Erica Moo reports, many extraordinary singers perform in quite unexpected places.
It's a typical Wednesday afternoon at the Presidio YMCA. Swimmers are paddling their way back and forth across the pool. But then the lifeguards start singing.
My name is Jefferson Taylor. I am from San Francisco. I am a teacher, lifeguard, and swim instructor at the Presidio Y, and I'm on operatic baritone. So when it's really quiet and you don't hear a lot of splashing, I'll go for a good hour just singing what I want.
Jefferson Taylor is an opera singer.
I am a baby in the opera world.
An aspiring opera singer.
Which means working the job that you need to support the job that doesn't pay anything yet.
Like lifeguarding.
Working at like a trampoline park. Doing discrimination research project. Working for the U.S. Census.
That's soprano Seanette Sulker, who also lives in San Francisco. For Taylor, Sulker, and other opera hopefuls, the winter months mean more opportunities to sing at churches and holiday performances. It also means audition season. Flights to New York, singing in front of judges.
Usually it's 1 to 3 people, and they usually are behind a table.
Come audition for us, then we'll decide what we're going to do. And then you might not get a call back, or you'll get a call back 6 months later.
The last 10 years have really been turbulent in our economy.
That's Indre Viscontis. She's a neuroscientist and a TV show host and an opera singer.
And it seems to me that, and to a lot of people, that the middle class is the one that's really getting lost in the shuffle. So the same thing, I think, is happening in the classical music world.
Viscontis is helping singers like Taylor and Sulker, and herself, find a way to the main stage.
We're starting to take back the power of reaching an audience ourselves, because we just get tired of having the decision-making be really tied into these huge companies. And, you know, we wanted to just be able to do our art without having to get permission from someone on a granting panel.
Here's how this world works. Opera houses are ranked by Opera America based on their budgets. You've got your C houses, like West Edge Opera in Berkeley, your B houses, San Jose Opera, and your A houses, San Francisco Opera. To get to the top, you need talent and luck. But what Viscontis and her collaborator, Katie Gerber, are doing is cutting out the house and replacing it with a bar. Yep, the kind with bar stools and booze. Viscontis's project is called Opera on Tap.
Hello, and welcome to Opera on Tap San Francisco.
Yeah!
We're at Cafe Royale in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. It's Saturday night, and the bar is packed to the rafters with patrons sipping wine and beer. And they're eating Sulker's performance up. She's walking around the bar, sitting on men's laps, flirting, doing all the things that you would never expect from an opera singer at the Met. Opera on Tap is fun, and the price, free, beats the $30 nosebleed tickets for the big-name opera house down the street.
It's different because it's more intimate in some ways. You really do see the expressions on people's faces. You get to see if they're enjoying it, if they're following with you.
There isn't really a stage at Café Royale. No sets, no orchestra.
So I think the communication gulf is much, much smaller because it's literally right there next to you.
What I realized this time was not a lot of people had expectations. Their only expectation was we want to be entertained.
Jefferson Taylor, the singing YMCA lifeguard, is here tonight as well. He's painted his entire face with red and black paint for his performance as the devil in Faust. The point of Opera on Tap is not to put on a big production. It's to create opportunities.
Because it's kind of a mystery as to how people make it and become stars in the opera world.
Again, co-founder Indre Viscontis.
And nowadays, a lot of companies have young artist programs, and so the path seems a little bit more obvious.
A young artist's program is basically a paid internship to train and understudy with an opera house. But there are few spots in these programs, which means everyone else has to figure out another way into the industry. And what Opera on Tap is meant to do, or at least what Viscontis hopes it will do, is provide another set of dots that connect to the main stage. No one's been whisked away to La Scala yet, but Jefferson Taylor has gotten a few singing gigs after an audience member saw him perform at Café Royale.
So the goal is mostly just to be able to keep doing it.
I actually tried really hard not to have a career in opera.
Again, Indre Viscontis.
Because I knew that the road to being an opera singer was fraught with a lot of heartache. When you love something like that so much, you know, you either have to deny it in some way or you just have to accept it and keep doing it.
Just like its stories, the opera world is filled with trial and tribulation, triumph and disappointment. Viscontis hopes that by changing the scenery, Opera Untapped can open many doors to a community of fellow aspiring singers, to the hearts of a new audience, and, just maybe, to the stage at an A house. In San Francisco, I'm Erica Mu for Cross Currents. You can hear Opera on Tap at Cafe Royale in San Francisco this Saturday night at 7:30. You can find out more information at kalw.org. That's also where you can hear all of our stories, find more local coverage, and subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Sanaa Bhabha, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Jordan Katz, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Katie Steyer. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. You can find them online at citycarshare.org. Also, thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing is by composer Terry Riley. He's performing a benefit concert for the Old First Church in San Francisco Friday night starting at 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.